and the narratives, they developed a very, very powerful and simple to understand narrative. If you make your land productive through agrochemicals, if you reorient your agriculture into market, then you can produce more and you can feed your own people. So we bought that story, that narrative. Slowly but surely, our agriculture starts to be owned by few companies. That's where you lose your ownership, you know, that the sovereignty.
What does it mean to be in control of your food system? The practices, the technologies, the values. This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. In this episode, we're talking about food. There is little doubt that today, the vast majority of us have all but lost any connection to how our food is harvested, processed, transported, and prepared. But many people are fighting to get that control, that food sovereignty, back. Food sovereignty is the mission of the world's largest social movements, including groups such as La Via Campesina and the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa. Dr. Million Belay, the general coordinator of the latter organization, is on a lifelong mission to change the narrative about how we grow food and solve big problems. I reached out to Million to talk about food sovereignty, agroecology, and changing the narrative about what food systems are for. This conversation is about challenging assumptions and dogma about the past, present, and future of our food. Let's dig in. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Million Belay. Million has been working for over two decades on agriculture and the rights of local communities to seed and food sovereignty and forest issues. He is the general coordinator for the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa, which is the largest social alliance on the continent. Million has a PhD in environmental learning and is a member of the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems. Million, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, oh, thank you. I always enjoy talking to you.
As you know, food sovereignty is a mission that unites millions of people. But what I've found, and I'm guessing you have too, is that food sovereignty is a term that many have never encountered. Can you start us off by explaining food sovereignty and why it has become such a common motivation for so many people around the world fighting for change?
I think to make it so simple for people to understand, I would pin it on two critical concepts, which is basically self-sufficiency on one hand, and on the other, local ownership. Self-sufficiency is very much important, both at the household level, at the community level, and also at the country level. At the community level, the importance of self-sufficiency was accentuated due to COVID. You know, COVID has made a lot of people in a lot of countries aware that I think they have to really work for themselves. You know, they have to be self-sufficient, especially in food. As you know, the urban communities have suffered quite a lot, you know, because of COVID, and rural communities also. Those communities would depend on inputs that are coming from the outside, you know, on seed and artificial fertilizers and others have actually suffered. The second one is local ownership, you know, ownership of your land, ownership of your seed, ownership of your water, basically your life. When others own your life through your seed, water, land, biodiversity, then you are not sovereign. When people ask me about what food sovereignty is, and if when you basically break it down to this concept, then they do really understand. But we don't forget also the bigger conceptual differences with food security, you know? Mm-hmm. Food security does not talk about local ownership. Right. It does not talk about also self-sufficiency. You know, food produced anywhere, by whatever means, coming to your table, and not necessarily culturally appropriate, you know? Mm-hmm. So that differentiates food sovereignty and food security And that's why the concept of food sovereignty is much more uniting and much more powerful for me.
So at its heart, it strikes me that food sovereignty is also about voice and about being able to set the parameters for the entire food system. It's the food that you want and you need. It's culturally preferred food. In your assessment, how have we reached this place where so many people, millions, arguably billions of people, are so disempowered with respect to their food?
I think it's gradual. You know, it didn't happen overnight. It started to happen when corporations started to have a legal personality, when individuals who are responsible for creating problems are not anymore accountable, you know, that they are registered in the name of corporations. So these corporations, you know, they have to please only their owners and their shareholders, you know. If you are head of a company, I think your priority is not towards the earth or towards water, land, you know, all things that we consider as really critical are not critical for them. The most critical thing is the profit. When you bring that to continents like Africa, companies in the West, they wanted resources, they came to Africa. Mm-hmm. And they reoriented our agriculture into commercial agriculture, you know, producing for the market.
I see.
Because the narrative is that, you know, if you produce more, single crop or two or three crops, and if you sell them, then you will get money and you can buy your own food. That's a narrative. That's where you lose your ownership, you know, that's the sovereignty. So that was bought by the local elites. That was enforced by force, as you know, by the colonial masters. And that was enforced by law. And the narratives, they developed a very, very powerful and simple to understand narrative. If you have high yielding varieties in terms of seeds, if you make your land productive through agrochemicals, you know, if you reorient your agriculture into market, you know, then you can produce more and you can feed your own people. So we bought that story, that narrative. So slowly, but surely, our agriculture starts to be owned by few companies.
And why doesn't the narrative that you grow the food, you make more money, you can buy more food, why doesn't it work out? Because I think that's such a hard thing for people to get their heads around, why that doesn't work out the way that the story, the myth tells us that it's going to.
Basically, agrochemicals kill your soil. The pesticides that you use also kill the biodiversity around you. It makes the land poorer. Focusing on few crops reduces your resilience. You know, when something like climate change or a pest outbreak or something comes, then you're vulnerable to that attack. So that basic loss of your resilience and basic loss of the social resilience also. Mm. You know, people used to collaborate and they work together. Industrial agriculture, this green revolution agenda breaks people apart. That social fabric is broken because instead of the web of relationship that you have among people in the land, that is hugely challenged by industrial agriculture. So you're much more vulnerable to the vagaries of market. You know, you can't rely on market. Market goes up, market goes down.
So you brought us to environmental issues. You talked about soil and, you know, our food systems are so implicated in biodiversity loss, climate change, and so forth. And for so long, that's just been the story that's been told about that is that that's just a necessary trade-off, that producing food causes impacts. And what I hear you saying, and of course, what I've experienced in my own work is that that's another nice little just so story that we've been told and are telling ourselves to justify this approach to producing food that doesn't work for the people and it doesn't work for the planet. So I wonder, can you tell me about agroecology? And because I know you get really excited about it, and I would like more people to get excited about it and understand why it's so quickly dismissed.
So agroecology, actually, I'm very, very much excited about agroecology because, you know, it produces more food. It's very sad to quickly dismiss it. It's becoming very difficult to dismiss it. So, you know, I don't know whether you've seen a recent report by Agropolis. This is a collaboration by a number of French scientists, you know, from over 100 countries. And you know, a lot of cases. I think more than 150 scientists have collaborated. They went back in the last 10 years and they looked at the kind of agroecological research that they've done. And it's a very, very powerful narrative now that agroecology works. So as a science, it's very difficult to refute that agroecology doesn't work. As a practice, a lot of farmers, you know, and if you go to our website, you know, we have a number of researches, a case studies which shows that agroecology works. So who says it doesn't work? Those who are controlling the food system, you know, throughout the food chain, you know? Mm-hmm. Those who are big producers of one kind of crops, you know, maize, soya and whatever. They feel threatened, you see.
Mm-hmm.
The question is on what do you measure? You know, what do you measure? Are you measuring the productivity of a single crop? Or are you measuring the resilience of a farm, the biodiversity in the farm? And are you measuring also the true cost accounting?
It really redefines what our food systems are for. You know, it's not just this conversation about yield. It's soybeans.
Yeah.
But requires that we, as you said, think about the land, think about, you know, working conditions, thinking about the quality of the soil, think about ecosystem services. And in your previous answer, you really, I think, indicted the private sector. And I'm curious to know, if we were envisioning a future that was food sovereign, what is the future for a private sector if communities have achieved food sovereignty? Is there one?
There are a number of companies who are very much innovative, who are trying things, who are coming up with ideas, who are becoming a positive force because they are light on the food, as you say. They can easily change, they can easily adapt. But the bigger companies, that will be very, very difficult for them. Basically, their nature makes it very, very much difficult to be radical, to go with radical agendas, to change.
And I wonder, do you have a, you know, if we could get applied for a bit, do you have a story or an anecdote of something that you and your organization has been involved in that has just really, where you've seen agroecology just turn things around?
Yeah. Can give you the 20 stories. One story that excites me is about the leafy vegetables story in Kenya.
In Kenya.
Due to colonialism, you know, the green leafy vegetables were neglected, you know, as a food. And suddenly, because of the traditional herbalists, traditional healers, you know, coming out on a TV and talking about the nutrition capacity of these leafy vegetables, the interest in consumers grow, and the supermarkets start to hold this green leafy vegetable. Because the supermarkets hold it, and because there is interest in consumers, then farmers start to grow. That increased the productivity. And obviously, farmers would eat this green leafy vegetables at their home. So that's one story, you know, consumer and farmers connection and demand-driven growth of agroecology and the scaling up of agroecology. Second story that I can tell you is about the knowledge, using the knowledge of people. This is a story in Malawi. Mm. And the focus of the government was on maize, you know, producing much more maize. And obviously, that would result in nutritional deficiency. This organization started to work on permaculture with local communities. So they brought elders, the woman elders, and they have asked them, are there any vegetables that you can eat? And can you tell us a name, where we can get them and access them? And they told them more than 300. Can you imagine? Which are already there. So they brought all these vegetables and start to grow them in their permaculture garden. And because of that, you know, the productivity increases. Because of they are applying a range of methods, and they can sell, and nutrition increases, diversity increases, all that. You see, it is possible. Do you want more?
No, well, I think those are two really good examples, and I think they contrast so well. You know, you're talking about an agroecological system producing food that is healthy and nutritious and can address nutritional deficiencies that people are experiencing in a way that benefits local ecosystems and local communities, as opposed to, say, developing a strain of rice that has more beta carotene in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, is it, why hand over, I've always wondered, why hand over more control to a corporation selling fortified rice when there's loads of foods that could be grown, that people want to grow, that people are growing, that meet those nutritional needs already?
You see, I want to call to talk about a creation of an institution in Africa, which is called the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa. It was created through the collaboration of Bill Gates and the Rockefeller Foundation. So when they started in 2006, they said our purpose is to double productivity and reduce food shortage by 30%, get about 30 million people out of poverty in 13 African countries. So what is it? What is the agenda? Green Revolution agenda. The narrative that I told you, if you really have high yielding varieties, focus on a few marketable crops, use agrochemicals, use irrigation and knowledge management, you know, and availability of funding, then it can work. After 13 years, research was done by collaboration of, Europe-based and Africa-based civil society organization, research. And research have shown that poverty is much worse, nutrition is much worse, undernourishment. This initiative has indebted farmers. This initiative has decreased the availability of local crops. Mm. A negative assessment. The only thing positive is that they could be able to influence our policies, fertilizer-related policies, seed-related policies, pesticide-related policies. They even rewrote the policies of some countries. That is a success, which we consider as disastrous.
It seems reasonable that something called the Green Revolution would be widely considered a good thing. But remember the axiom, history is written by the winners. And the winners in the Green Revolution were large-scale agribusiness, global commodity markets, and those of us who enjoy cheap food in the countries of the global north. In short, the Green Revolution refers to a period in the mid-20th century when developed northern economies, such as the United States, aggressively promoted industrial food production practices and technologies. This happened in locales including Mexico and India. The revolution entirely remade food systems around a few commodity crops and did succeed in dramatically increasing food production. But it also destabilized traditional cultures and land stewardship practices and made food systems in these regions fully dependent on global suppliers and global markets. There were winners, sure, but those winners largely were not locals. Rather, locals experienced violence, loss of control, and loss of sovereignty. If the Green Revolution had been as successful as its proponents claim it was, then why is a counter-movement, the movement for food sovereignty, the largest social movement on the planet? So when Million invokes the Green Revolution, I hear in his words the frustration of billions of people across history who were harmed by its violence and cultural supremacy. Back to the interview.
So that is a reason that these people come with a lot of money, lots of money.
Yeah, you're talking about, you know, as you said, very influential organizations, very influential corporations with long reach. You know, I think about that and I think, well, gosh, however do you affect change under the shadow of such influential individuals and organizations? But then you also mentioned COVID-19, and I feel like there's a bit of an awareness now that maybe the grip of this sort of large corporate system, agro-industrial complex, if you want to call it that, is more vulnerable than they are willing to admit and than we've ever realized. And perhaps we're at a point, and this is the premise of the show, perhaps we're at a point where if we push in the right ways, major change could be possible. So what do you see as the most exciting opportunities for people wanting to push for change?
I think the COVID narrative is very much important. The climate crisis is also an opportunity. Now people are realizing that food production alone is not enough. I think we need to do to have a mitigation strategy and also an adaptation strategy. Agroecology fits both. You see, that's a fantastic strategy. And people want to talk about, you know, market-based strategy. So where we were exploring whether agroecological markets are possible, whether they can increase people's income or not. And the concept of territorial marketing is gaining currency. So there are a number of opportunities coming up.
So I can tell, I've always known every time I speak with you that despite the size of these issues, you are always very optimistic about opportunity and where things could go. And so, you know, the last thing that I'm asking every guest on the show to reflect on is a radical change that they hope to see manifest in their lifetime.
I think for me, coming to a continent where the majority of the people depend on agriculture, for me, agroecology is a radical agenda. It's a radical manifestation. And I actually feel that it can happen if even half of the money that's dedicated to industrial agriculture goes to agroecology. And that, I hope, will happen at some stage, because I see also the change in people who have conceived and who were supporting industrial agriculture. So I'm hopeful.
I'm hopeful too. Thanks for that. Million, thank you so much for joining me for this. I really appreciate it. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you about these issues.
I thank you so much. You always ask really excellent questions. Thank you so much for having me.
This episode of the Second Transition Podcast was produced on the traditional lands and territories of the Washoe people in what is now known as Northeastern California. Funding for this podcast comes in part from the Arrow Food Institute, from the University of Guelph, and from Voice Ed Radio. My guest today was Dr. Million Belay, General Coordinator for the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa. You can learn more about his important work at afsaafrica.org, and can follow Million on Twitter at @Million_Belay. Links to the resources that he mentioned are available in the episode notes. See you next time.